Welcome to Sanctuary Church Teaching Podcast. To learn more about Sanctuary, check out sanctuaryri.org or our Instagram for the latest news, or stop by on a Sunday morning. The content you're about to hear was designed for our context and congregation, but we hope it can become a blessing for you.
Isn't it good to be in the house of the Lord, friends? I always wake up like way too early on Sunday, and I'm like, oh man, I wanted to sleep in. But now that I'm here, I'm like, there's no better way to spend your Sunday morning, is there? There's nothing better we could be doing than here together in the presence of the Lord. So, all right, well, it's that time. It's that time for the reading of the word. So as is our custom, would you stand up now that you just sat down? Stand for the reading of the word. Today's scripture comes from Paul's letter to the Thessalonians, the second chapter. Starting in verse 1. You know, brothers and sisters, that our visit to you was not without results. We had previously suffered and had been treated outrageously in Philippi, as you know. But with the help of our God, we dared to tell you his gospel in the face of strong opposition. For the appeal we make does not spring from error or impure motives, nor are we trying to trick you. On the contrary, we speak as those approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. We're not trying to please people, but God, who tests our hearts. You know we never use flattery, nor did we put on a mask to cover up greed. God is our witness. We are not looking for praise from people, not from you or anyone else, even though as apostles of Christ, we could have asserted our authority. Instead, we were like young children among you. And just as a nursing mother cares for her children, so we cared for you because we loved you so much. We were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. Surely you remember, brothers and sisters, our toil and hardship. We worked night and day in order not to be a burden to anyone while we preach the gospel of God to you. You are witnesses, and so is God, of how holy, righteous, and blameless we were among you who believed. For you know that we dealt with you, as each of you, as a father deals with his own children, encouraging, comforting, and urging you to live lives worthy of God who calls you into his kingdom and glory. And this, friends, is the word of the Lord. Okay, you can have a seat. So I'm in a tough spot this morning. I'll tell you about the pickle I'm in as a preacher. Because Adam Croft, where are you, Adam? Somewhere. He told me that if I don't use an eclipse metaphor in my sermon, he's going to come after me. And you know me, right? I am the science nerd of all science nerds. I'm the metaphor king. And so Adam said, if Greg, after there's been like a solar eclipse, if you don't find a way to preach on the eclipse, I'm not going to be your friend anymore, and you will have failed as a preacher. So, but I'm like, bro, I'm trying to preach on being a saint. Because that's what, in case you missed last week, we were in a new series in Eastertide called All Saints, and we're studying Paul's letter to the Thessalonians, and we're trying to figure out what does it mean to be saints. And I know some of us, when we hear that word, we have baggage. We're like, I'm not like a, you know, person on an icon or anything. But by saints, what we just mean is people of uncommon goodness. And in fact, actually, we're all called to be saints. 1 Corinthians, Paul opens the letter. He addresses those called to be saints. You know, so Paul thinks about every believer is called to be a person of uncommon goodness. And so Adam says, Greg, if you don't preach on the eclipse, it's game over for you. But I'm like, but Andrew wants me to preach on being saints, and I don't know what to do. I'm like, this is a square peg in a round hole. There's no way unless, and then it hit me, that in order to see the eclipse, maybe we have a picture of me up here. Oh, we have a picture. We went up there, by the way, to Maine, or to Vermont. We were like 2 miles from the border. We heard it was going to be cloudy, and so I rented an Airbnb a year ago because I knew it was coming. Because you could predict. You can predict. 2044, by the way, you want to be in North Dakota. That's when the next one's coming. But anyway, if you want to see an eclipse, what do you have to have? You got to have glasses. You really don't want to look at until totality, which, by the way, if you get a chance, definitely you got to see it. It's like nothing I've ever seen. But without those special glasses, you can't see the eclipse. You can't see it without damaging your eyes. But here's the thing, friends. We don't just wear glasses to look at the eclipse. We actually, all of us, every single one of us, wears glasses every day. And I'm not talking about these babies. I'm talking about in order to see and understand the world, we have to have a mental framework. We have to have something called a mindset. Chris Soddy actually introduced me, and most of the guys, raise your hand if you were around for Soddy's teaching on mindset. It was one of the first times I thought about this, but actually, a mindset is a framework for interpreting and giving meaning to the world. And it actually, the glasses we wear predetermine how we are going to interpret the world around us, how we are going to define success and failure, and whether or not we achieve our goals. It'll tell you what your goals are and whether or not you achieve them. And Carol Dweck is a Stanford psychologist. She says, actually, your mindset is the central determining factor for achievement and success in your life. First of all, it tells you what achievement even is supposed to look like, and then it will tell you whether or not you're going to get it. And so in that sense, the lenses we wear might be the most important things about us, the mindset lenses we wear. And actually, I would say that without the right glasses, you'll never become a saint. Without the right glasses, you can't look at the sun. And without the right glasses, the first step to becoming a person of uncommon goodness is to check your mindset. So Paul says in Romans 12, by the way, remember, he says, don't be conformed to the pattern of the world, but be transformed by the what? By the renewing of your mind. So it all starts there. And so that's what I want to talk about. Actually, what's cool about 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, and I was studying this, and sometimes you got to take several passes at it, but as I was studying it, I realized this is actually a glimpse into the mindset of a saint. This is Paul's mindset. He begins the chapter, verse 1. He says, you know, brothers and sisters, the NIV says, our visit to you was not without results. The Greek word there is kinos, but other translations of it, our visit to you wasn't empty. It wasn't vain. It wasn't foolish. It didn't come up empty-handed. And in other words, basically what he's saying is, our visit to you was not a failure. It's a powerful word, failure. Very motivating word for me. Our visit was not a failure. That's my primary goal in life, is to not fail, by the way. So I'm like, oh, okay. I want to know, what does failure look like for Paul? And as I was studying this passage, I was tempted to skip over this, but then I realized this is the key to understanding the whole thing. Our visit to you was not a failure. Why not, Paul? Because it sure looked like a failure from the outside. The background, if you weren't here last week, Paul has just come, he has come from Thessaloniki or Thessalonica, whatever you want to call it, and he arrived there and preached the gospel. It says for 3 Sabbath days he preached. So for 3 weeks, he's in this town, he's preaching, and quite a few people came to faith, but then also an angry mob showed up and drove him out of town. And so he fled to the next city. He fled to Berea, and the folks from Thessalonica were so angry, they followed him to the next city and drove him out of there too. And then he made it to Athens, which he could hide out in Athens. So I don't know about you, but 3 weeks in a town and then being beat up and driven out of that town and the next town feels like, how are you seeing that as a success? Help me understand that, Paul. And so that's what I want to talk about, because the glasses through which Paul understands his experience is not just what happened to him, but his mindset glasses are actually very important for us if we want to become people of uncommon goodness. So we don't often look at the glass, we look through glasses, right? But this morning I want to invite us, let's take off and see, what are you looking through, Paul, so that you would say this is not a failure? So I want to look this morning at 3 ways a saint defines success, okay? Follow me? Everyone ready to rock? 3 ways? So the first way, a saint defines success as doing the right thing even when it's difficult. Okay, saint defines, success for a saint is whether or not they did the right thing, and especially if it was difficult. So Paul starts out, he says, it wasn't a failure, it wasn't a vain, it wasn't a flop. But here's what's weird to me. Paul doesn't actually say anything in that first part of the passage. He gets there later, but he doesn't say anything about how the Thessalonians responded. He doesn't talk about, did they make any followers on Instagram or social media? Did they talk about how many people believed? If anything went up and to the right? And then he says, why was it not a failure? He says it was not a failure because of what happened back at Philippi. It has absolutely nothing to do, right? He says, our visit was not without results. We had previously suffered and been treated outrageously at Philippi. Okay, so now success doesn't even have to do with the Thessalonians. It has to do with what happened in Philippi. What happened in Philippi? Well, if you remember, Paul was arrested. He was flogged and beaten. He was stripped publicly, and he was jailed. So I don't get it. How was what happened in Thessaloniki a success? And here's what Paul says. Because of, in spite of everything that happened in Philippi, Paul and Silas and Timothy dared to speak the gospel again. Does that make sense? He was arrested, flogged, unjustly beaten, stripped naked, jailed. And yet, they had the courage. It says, we dared to tell you this gospel. They went to the next town. That's what made it a success. And if you think about it, right, this is actually what we celebrate saints for, isn't it? What do we celebrate? Think back on the people that we most revere in the history of the church, even in human history. We don't celebrate the people that do easy stuff, do we? Who do we celebrate? We don't celebrate people that do the wrong thing. We celebrate people that do the right thing even when it's hard. Think about Rosa Parks. We had her picture up there. What did Rosa Parks do? The right thing, even though it was hard. What did Martin Luther King do? Nelson Mandela, Mother Teresa, St. Patrick. They all did the right thing, even when it wasn't easy. All the apostles, they were all either martyred or exiled. What did they do? They did the right thing when it wasn't easy. And how we define success is critical. It's a critical component to our mindset. And so success for a saint, for a person of uncommon goodness, is did I do the right thing even when it was hard? So here's my question. All right, Greg, this sounds easy. The question is, how do we actually determine success and failure? How do you determine it? How do I determine it? Because that will determine the kind of person we eventually become. What glasses are you wearing? You know, one of the things that happened before the eclipse, by the way, is, did you hear about all the scams about the glasses? You know, there were all kinds of companies that, you know, there's only so many eclipse glasses you can make, and nobody wants them until right beforehand. And so people are like, awesome, let's make eclipse glasses that don't actually work, but we'll sell them as eclipse glasses. And so a lot of people bought these things on Amazon or whatever. I don't know where they were made. And they say, hey, I'm an eclipse glass. Put me on. Look at the sun. And you could do that. You could put them on. You could look at the sun through them. But what would happen? Yeah, they'd give a sunburn to your retinas. It'd damage your eyesight. Not a good thing, right? But I think the world gives us glasses to define success all the time, doesn't it? It's always giving us glasses. It's always telling us, hey, look at the world through these lenses. Define success and failure through these lenses. The problem is, if we do that, it will actually end up damaging us, won't it? But these lenses are not asking, here's what these lenses are asking. Will I be comfortable? Will I have enough money? Will my kids be comfortable? Will my kids have enough money? Will kids in school think I'm cool? Will I get into the right college or grad school or the right fellowship? Will I be able to retire at the age I want? Will I advance in my career? Will I achieve fame and notoriety? Will my boss approve of me and promote me? Will I find a spouse or a life partner? Will I take vacations to awesome places frequently? Will I have a job I feel passionate about? Will what I say about my resume sound good at a cocktail party? Will I have good friends? Will I make something out of my life? Will I live to be 100? Will people like me and follow my posts and all my stuff that I put out on social media, right? Those are things that we're all tempted. We are all tempted to define success and failure by questions that a saint doesn't use. But here's what I want to say. These questions will actually damage us. If we look at the world for our whole lives through these things, it will do damage to our soul. Why? Because at the end of our lives, on our deathbeds, when we're prepared to face eternity, these questions simply won't matter. Amen? At the end of our lives, when we look into eternity, there's a whole different set of questions that will matter to us. Did I love my kids? Did I do the right thing? Did I do what Jesus told me to do? In spite of the suffering, in spite of the mobs, in spite of the fear, imprisonment, in spite of all the voices screaming at Paul, he talked about Jesus in the next town. And so Paul says it was a success. What does this look like in our lives? What would it look like? I was thinking about this for me. I need to learn how to not define success by my work. Right? I have been taught and raised in my, I don't know, German, Scandinavian immigrant heritage to value my 9-to-5 job, which I don't have because I'm a pastor, but if I had one, I would value that and how I succeed in that as the most important determining factor of my worth and value. Is anyone tempted to do that? Did anyone grow up with that? I remember my grandfather just, you know, his only thing, he would talk to us, he'd say, work hard, man, work hard. Like, this is the main goal of life, is to work hard, be successful, climb the ladder. The only problem is that all the time that value is coming into conflict with my family life, right? I'm always feeling that tug. And it's very hard for me to let go of that, but I'm realizing at the end of my life, I will not care if I worked 40, 50, or 60 hours. I will care about the relationship I have with my kids. That's a deathbed question, right? We live in a world, every voice around us is telling us that being part of a complete and fulfilled human being is having sex all as much as we want with whoever we want to. Every show we watch. Have you noticed, by the way, you ever watch Netflix shows? Do you notice there's a sex scene in every show? There is. It's part of being a fulfilling human being in our time and place is being sexually fulfilled. And yet, God has called many of us not to be married. And he's called all Christians to reserve that for a special covenant relationship. And yet, we feel this deep desire for intimacy and all these voices saying, if you don't satisfy this, you're going to be unfulfilled as a human being. And I would say, actually, you know what success would mean to a saint? It means surrendering and submitting all of ourselves to the Lord, including our sexuality. Some of us have broken relationships in our lives. Relationships that it would be painful even to think about reconciling. Maybe being a saint is doing the right thing, even though it's hard. Maybe being a saint is reaching out to people with broken relationships and pursuing healing in as much as it depends on us. Some of us, the hard thing is to forego a career advancement because God has called us to double down on kingdom community. For some of us, the hard thing is confessing a sin in our lives. Maybe there's something we hold inside that we're ashamed of. We would actually be set free if we told someone, but it's hard. And the right thing is to confess it to the Lord and other people. But that's what saints do. Does that make sense? They do the right thing regardless of the cost. Some of us know that we're called to get involved in some kind of justice issue. Maybe our kid's school is a total disaster. And we know that Jesus is actually inviting us to join the PTA. Anyway, I don't know what it is for you, but I do know this. Following Jesus is not easy. But what saints do, they define success by doing the right thing regardless of the cost. I was thinking about this. As I think about saints, I always, and I know I always talk about her, but sorry. She's like the closest saint to me. My mother-in-law was a saint, Hallie. And some of you guys knew her, and she was just an incredible, amazing woman. And she got sick late in her life, you know, I don't know, around 60. She got a neurodegenerative disease. It was a terrible disease, multiple systems atrophy. She slowly began to lose her ability to move her body. Her autonomic nervous system began to fail. So eventually she couldn't even talk. She couldn't communicate. And when she first got sick, I prayed, Lord, like, heal Hallie. And I got all kinds of people together. You know, we got lots of oil. You know, we just put as much oil on her as we could. We had prayer sessions. And I was seeking God for her healing. For years, I was praying that God would heal her. But he didn't. And as she got sicker and sicker, you know, I didn't know what to do about it. And, you know, that's part of my story, emotionally checked out. I didn't know how to connect with her because she wasn't talking. But as I look back at her life, the lasting legacy of Hallie, a lot of it is about what she did in her, you know, 60 years of life before she got sick. But the part that really sticks with me is how she died, how she approached death, how she faced the loss of all of her capacities. And everyone who knew her would tell you that she never complained. She did it the whole time with Jesus. And there was this incredible grace about how she approached the end of her life that I realize is her lasting legacy. Her character shone. It was like a diamond. It was like a polished gem as she faced the end of her life. And so that's what saints do. It's not about things being easy for us. It's not about upward mobility. It's about doing the right thing in the face of suffering. But here's the second thing I want to say. Saints define success as doing the right thing for the right reasons. So Paul, in this chapter, he talks a ton about motivations. So he's like, the appeal we make does not spring from error or impure motives. We're not trying to trick you. We're not trying to please people. We never use flattery. We didn't put on a mask to cover up greed. We were not looking for praise from people. He like repeatedly is like, we didn't do it for this. We didn't do it for this. We didn't preach the gospel for these reasons. We didn't do it for these reasons. We didn't do it for these reasons. Why is Paul so concerned about his motivation? Why do you think? Because motives matter for being a saint. We could do all the right things, by the way, for the wrong reasons. I've done the right things for the wrong reasons. We can do it to look good, to please people, to make a name for ourselves. We can do it to be successful, to get people to like us. What's the difference? Why does it matter what our motives are? And I would say, first of all, it matters to God. Because God sees our hearts. Man looks on the outward appearance, but what does God look at? He looks at the heart. Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, hey, don't fast and pray and do your giving in public to be seen by men. Do it in secret because your Father sees what's done in secret. He sees the heart. Paul says, we didn't do it to please people, but we did it to please God who tests our hearts. Our motives matter to the Lord. He sees our hearts. He sees the inward parts. Psalm 51, you desire truth in the inward parts. God is interested in our insides and our outsides being in alignment. He's interested in what's called integrity, oneness. He's interested in the heart. He's the only person whose opinion ultimately accounts to a saint. And so some of us, I just be honest, and I throw myself in this category. Some of us hide things. We try to hide them from God. We definitely hide them from other people. Some of us, maybe we've been serving in church, doing all the right stuff, but deep inside there's a bitter spirit, or we're doing it to compare ourselves to others or compete with them or to be noticed. The motives matter to God. Who may ascend the hill of the Lord? He who has clean hands and a pure heart. And so this is the thing I just want to say, like, this is, you guys know me, I'm into revival. I think this is so important in revival. I've been thinking about it. The heart. It's like God is testing hearts. He said, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. And there's something about having a pure heart that actually qualifies us to hold his presence. God is looking for the reasons why we serve. He's sifting our hearts. I was talking with David Thomas. I don't know if you guys remember. He came here for the prayer thing. We had like 500 people here praying for revival. I just saw him and I felt like I was in kindergarten. I just said, can you be my friend? Like, I'd like to be your friend. I would like to know more of who you are. I would like what you have in you to rub off on me. And so I had a phone call with my new friend, David, last week. We talked on the phone. It was the weirdest phone call. Because I'm like, normally I'd have some agenda or something. I'm just like, I don't know what to say. I just want to get to know you. But I asked him like, what was the hardest part? Because he was really entrusted by God to steward the outpouring that happened at Asbury. And I said, hey, what was the hardest part of that? And so besides like lack of sleep and, you know, whatever, he said before, when he first heard that the Holy Spirit had like descended into Hughes Auditorium and people had asked him to come and to help lead it and to help steward it, he heard the Lord say to him, your flesh has to die. All of the mixed motives, all the other agendas, they can't go in there. And he had an image of even like, you know, taking his flesh. It was a violent image of stepping on its neck, killing it. But that everything he did had to be out of the heart to love God. Nothing else would do. That was what God was looking for. And that was his primary job, was to let Jesus kill off all the other agendas, all the other motivations, all the other stuff. And I think that's what God is doing in this season for his church. I think he wants to get us ready for renewal and revival, and he wants to get us ready to steward it and host it. I think there's going to be a wave of people that are going to start, like we're already seeing it, start showing up at church randomly. God drew me here. Like there are already stories emerging, but God's looking for people to lead that and steward it and care for all these new people. And the most important thing is our motivation. It's our heart. And I've learned this the hard way, guys. I have learned the hard way. I've done ministry for 20 years. And I would say this lesson's really important, because why we do things will eventually flavor the fruit of everything we do. I've seen stuff that I've done for the wrong reasons. People I've hired, people I've promoted because I wanted ministry to be successful. I've seen people that did incredible things for Jesus, but they harbored other motives in their heart. They wanted to be great. They wanted to be on stage. They wanted to be known. They wanted to be on the cutting edge. They wanted to be important. They wanted to do something significant. And over time, when those other motives didn't get surrendered to Jesus and didn't get put to death, eventually they edged Jesus out. And people went off in an entirely different direction. Thing is, specific people that I've poured my life into that have wandered away because they didn't do it for the right reasons. So the final thing, first two, success is doing the right thing even when it's hard. The second is success is doing it for the right reasons out of love for God. Here's the final thing I want to share. Saints define success as loving other people and helping them to love God too. So this is the other thing Paul wanted most. In addition to pleasing God, he wanted the Thessalonians to love God. He wanted them to love, you know, and he says in 1 Corinthians, he says, at the end, now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. At the end of all things. You know, one day when the eclipse comes fully, by the way, and it's coming, right? Right now, we're in the middle of the eclipse. The kingdom of God is slowly eclipsing the earth, the kingdoms of this world. One day, it'll be totality. And one day, everything will be laid bare. At the end of history, it'll all be laid bare. Everything we've done, all the reasons we've done it. And Paul says, at the end, only three things will matter: faith, hope, and love. They're the only things that remain. But the greatest of these is love. And that's the goal, the life goal of a saint is actually to learn how to love people. That's all it is. It's to love God and to love people. What are the two greatest commandments? The scribe asked Jesus, love God, love your neighbor. On this hang all the law and the prophets. So Paul says he succeeded in Philippi, in Thessalonica, because he says we were like young children among you. In other words, we were humble and vulnerable. We cared for you like a nursing mother cared for her children. Because we loved you so much, we didn't just share the gospel with you, we shared our lives as well. So in other words, Paul was not a professional, he was an amateur. All saints are amateurs. The word amateur is a Latin word. It literally just means lover. We don't do it for any other reason than love. It wasn't a game, it wasn't a job, it was love. And that's what I think of, like when I think of Hallie, my mother-in-law, what I'm struck by is to the bitter end, she loved. She loved the people around her, she loved me. In fact, one time, I think this is okay to share, her husband, Len, reached out to me because as she got sicker and sicker, I withdrew emotionally. I didn't know how to engage with it. And she was hurt by that. And so Len came and said, you know, we miss you, Greg. Hallie misses you. And it was hard for me because I was like, I don't know what to do with it. But to the very end, she loved me. She had this set of rocks, little pebbles by her prayer chair. Every day she would pray for them. She would move them from, you know, the thing to the basket or two baskets back and forth. At the end, she couldn't even pick them up, but she would touch them. And I had a rock and she prayed for me all the way to the end of her life. And that's what a saint does. So I want to just ask, and worship team, you can come forward. But we all wear glasses. We all wear them. We all wear glasses to look at life. We all have a set of lenses that define success and failure. We don't always look at them. We're not always aware of what they are. A lot of times we define success and failure by, you know, what Madison Avenue or the world tells us. But I'm inviting us actually to take Paul's glasses and to try them on. Because this is the first step to becoming a person of uncommon goodness, is putting on the right set of lenses. Andrew said last week, the greatest tragedy in life is not becoming a saint. This is who we're called to become. Because friends, one day we're gonna look like him. That is our goal in life. We're gonna see him as he is. We're gonna look at him face to face and we will be like him. And so the entire purpose of the 60 to 80 to 90 years of our life is actually for that character of Jesus to be formed in us now so that we look like him forever. One day, friends, totality's coming. On that day, we will all know the only questions that matter are eternity questions and deathbed questions. But a saint asks those questions in the middle of their life. That's how they become a person of uncommon goodness. And in the meantime, we're in the middle of the eclipse. Here you go, Adam, this is for you. We need glasses to see that heaven is overtaking the earth. It's hard to see sometimes. We see it, you know the eclipse, right? You put up a colander, you put up a pinhole camera, and you see it reflected on the ground. We see signs. But it's hard to see clearly. And so we have to put on the glasses of a saint. We have to assess reality, success and failure through God's lenses, to ask deathbed questions in the middle of life, to determine what matters most. Our purpose on earth is not our net worth, not our comfort, not our stuff, not happiness as our culture understands it, not numbing through the pain of life and going from one movie to the next or drink or experience, but it's to glorify God by looking like him, by doing the next right thing, in spite of the cost, especially because of the cost, because we love him and because we love our neighbors. That's what makes for a person of uncommon goodness. So I want to close. I actually want to close and just invite us into a moment of reflection. And the thing I want to ask, the other thing we need to become a saint, we can't just grind it out. We ask God to do those things in us. We ask God to do those things in one another. We pray and we ask, Lord, purify my heart. Lord, help me redetermine what I'm looking at to define success in my life. Lord, help me to love this person, that person, the hard people. But I want to start, can I be selfish? Because I'm on this sainthood journey too. And I just want to ask, because I have the mic here, before you pray for yourself on your pathway to saintness, would you pray for me?
So at this point in the sermon, I shared a personal story. I won't include all the details here, but the gist of it is that I had a certain vision for what my life would look like in my 40s. And as it turns out, God had an invitation for me to actually make a significant sacrifice and to let my life go in a very different direction from where I thought it would go. So I ask the congregation and I ask you to pray for me, to pray for me to have God's perspective, to put on the glasses of sainthood, to see and reevaluate success and failure through his lenses, through doing the right thing, regardless of the cost, and doing it out of love for Jesus, doing it out of love for those he's put in my life.
And then when you're done praying for me, just pray for yourself, because we're all on this journey together, right? This is who we're called to become. So pray that God would help you put on the right glasses and sift your heart and crucify your flesh and burn away your false motives so that all that remains is love for Jesus. Not your name, your reputation, your comfort, your well-being, your success in the eyes of others, but God who tests the heart. And then pray that he would teach you how to truly love the people around you so that you'd share with them not only the gospel, but your life as well. So Lord, as we close, would you move in us and transform us and make us into the people you've called us to be? I'll just take a minute, reflect with the Holy Spirit, pray into that, and then we're going to start worshiping and responding in a minute.